Hello. In this audio clip, we'll continue to talk about federalism in the context of the January 6th Commission bill that was recently defeated, you could say, due to a Senate filibuster. And that was seen, as we shared in the previous clip, as a proof or validation of the Senate and the whole filibuster system and federalism in general. By conservatives who are always looking for a way to reinforce their beliefs in the things that they idolize. But we saw in the previous clip that taking that as a validation of federalism and the filibuster system in the Senate is to congratulate, is the equivalent of congratulating a drunk driver for making an anonymous emergency call to get an ambulance to go help someone that they just ran over. So the whole issue with the January 6th Commission bill should have never happened if the Senate had done its job. And it didn't do its job, so then it had to step up and do what it did, and it did it, as we saw earlier, more out of political convenience than out of principle, because sadly only 35 people voted to continue the filibuster, if I'm not mistaken. So it was a small number of people. So the thing is that what we need to consider now is, let's say that, let's grant the point, just for a moment. Let's hypothetically assume that having a Senate and having a filibuster system is beneficial for the country, and that the problem is that we just don't have the right people. The system is perfect. We just happen to have all these bad seeds, these bad apples that make the system go awry, and it would happen with any other system. Let's assume that that's the case. But just as a side note, that's more or less like the argument that bad coaches in sports, let's say American football, make when they go season after season without winning. They have a bad system. They have inefficient coaching techniques, coaching strategies, game strategies, and they keep blaming their players for their defeats. And they always complain to the owners, if you just could get me good contracts with great players, then I could, take this team to a championship. But the reality is their system sucks. Their strategy, their methodology doesn't work. So it's not a matter of what players you bring in. No matter what you bring in, the system just does not work. And what we've had in America is a system that has more or less worked because the people who were around were not that terrible, but now that we have all these terrible people who have crept into the system, then we see its flaws in very vivid colors. And the problem, and I hope that this is what you're getting through these audio clips, the awareness that the bad people, the very bad people who are in power right now, are there because the system allowed it. It has so many loopholes, so many gaping holes, like the southern border, so many places where it's so easy to get across that it was just a matter of time, before our culture collapsed and degraded to the point that we would be allowing all these terrible people to overrun the system, and now it's out of control. So the system had flaws, so many gaping holes in it, that it was bound to fail. It was just a matter of time, and we have to realize that. But so going back to the original assumption, let's say that the filibuster is a good idea, the Senate is a good idea, and that the problem is just the bad people that are there. Okay, let's change the people. Okay, let's have the current situation right now, but with different people in the Senate. Let's say that we have, instead of 50 wishy-washy Republicans, we had 25 Mark Levins, and those of you who listen to American talk radio might know who I'm talking about. Probably the best conservative mind out there, American conservative mind. So let's say that 25 of them are, you know, DNA clones of Mark Levin. And then we have 11 who are DNA clones of Sean Hannity, another conservative commentator. And just to top it all off, 14, the remaining 14 are DNA clone copies of Rush Limbaugh. Somebody was able to get his DNA before he passed away, and they produced 36 new Rush Limbaughs. So I forget the number, but the thing is, so we have 25 Mark Levins. Let's say 13 Sean Hannitys, and or 11 Sean Hannitys, that's 36, and 14 Rush Limbaugh. So now we have a total of 50 rock solid conservative Republicans. All right, so now we have a different team, so we can't complain the way we were before. And just to make it easier, let's say that instead of having 50 Republicans the way we have right now at the time of this recording, let's say that there are 51 Republicans. So let's throw in an extra Mark Stein, another conservative, well-known conservative. There are now 51 Republicans, rock-solid conservatives in the Senate. Okay, now let's say that we want to put the Senate to good use. And we know what happened on January 6th. We know what happened in the elections of 2020 in America. And let's say that these 51 more solid conservatives want to use the Senate to fight back. And let's say that they come up with the idea that let's promote a bill that instead of calling for a commission to investigate who organized the January 6th protest around Capitol Hill, let's say that the bill promotes the forming of a commission to study or find out who killed Ashley Babbitt. What police officer killed Ashley Babbitt? The motivation behind the brutal slaying of that peaceful protester, and why the police on that day threw fire grenades into the crowd where there were men, women, and children when they were just standing there outside Capitol Hill, and why the police threw one of the protesters down like a two-story level height, and the person was badly injured. Let's form a commission to investigate this police brutality and to find out why the police were so adamant in trying to provoke the crowd into some big riot, because that is exactly what was happening on January 6th. Let's form a commission to do that. And so let's say one of the Mark Levin clones writes out the bill, and it goes to the Senate floor. And then what will happen? What do you think will happen? The 51 Republicans we just placed in this imaginary scenario will be all for the bill. But then you have the other 49 who will be Democrats, who will, more than likely, be opposed, completely opposed to the idea, because they know that if that such a thing ever happened, then a lot of things would get uncovered about, because the Capitol Police, the police in Washington, D.C., is controlled locally. And it's all because of this stupid federal system that we have. So the Capitol Police and Washington, D.C. is controlled by Democrats. It's run by Democrats. It has always been Democrat ever since I can recall as a kid. So, and I'm sure that these people were in cahoots with Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to instruct police, you be aggressive against this crowd because we want to incite a riot. We want something so that we can then use that as leverage to tyrannize the opposition, our opposition, even more. So the 49 Democrats would be totally against the bill. So the bill goes on the floor and it's going to pass. If it goes to vote, it's going to go 51-49 in favor and it will pass. But the 49 Democrats, the minority, are going to start filibustering. And the Republicans will try to end the filibuster. And what do you think will happen? When they vote on it, it's going to be 51-49 to end the filibuster and vote on the bill. But because you have to have 60% to end the filibuster, then the 51 Republican senators will be powerless and the bill will fail. So we see an example right there. Under the current circumstances, where the filibuster didn't allow us to do what needed to be done. And the problem is that if you have a system where you have elite senators who are imbued with elitism, you will never get them to have a consensus of 60% to do something that requires political courage. So we just saw an example right now where the filibuster would work against us. So just because it works a few times in our favor in a very minor way to counteract a little portion of all the other evil that it has allowed, using that as a justification for the filibuster and the Senate is stupid. And it goes to an important principle that I want to mention, that it's one of the tumors, I would call it, inside conservatism in America and in general throughout the world. But I see it much more strongly in America, maybe because I see it firsthand. I don't know. But the problem with American conservatism is it can be found in the word itself. One of the big problems is it's conservative. It conserves. It preserves. It is designed to be defensive. It is designed to let's conserve or preserve our values, our traditions, whatever we have, and circling the wagons to protect this precious thing that we supposedly have in our midst. The conservative mindset is never on the offensive. It's very defensive by nature because the word itself, conservative, makes for people who are very passive and who just do their best to just let things run as they are and only react when something that they are trying to protect is being attacked, you know, like security guards guarding a vault. So they never go on the offensive because all their mentality is about conserving. And that is similar, if you're an American football fan, to an offensive line player who is in the line of scrimmage there for the explicit purpose of holding off the defensive lineman and preventing him getting to the quarterback. And that's all that the conservatives do. They are a whole bunch of offensive linemen, but there's no quarterback and no running back behind it. So they're just defending. But the quarterback who has the ball behind them is never running, is never passing, because it's all very conservative. And therefore, there's very little forward progress. And they're usually just receding, going backwards, because they don't have a forward mentality. It's something innate in conservatism in America. And you contrast that with the left. The left is aggressive. The left goes forward, and, well, actually, they go backward, but, you know, they are in reverse. So from their perspective, they're going forward. And you see, radical groups like BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter. And I actually, you should know that their full acronym is BLM, B-O-I-N-K, B-A-B-L, BLM Boink Babble. And it stands for Black Lives Matter, but only if not killed by another black life. That is the full acronym of BLM, BLM Boink Babble. And the reason for that is that, as some of you may know, the percentage may vary, but from what I recall, and I believe that's more or less the average currently, 80%, around 80% or more, or 90%, I read in some places, of black people who are murdered by another black person. 90%, 80 to 90%. And this is not a recent phenomenon. It's been happening for decades and decades, for at least 5 or 6 decades. I remember as a kid living in Baltimore, maybe 10 blocks from what you could call ghetto land, and being aware of the tough conditions that existed in black communities, in black neighborhoods. Now, I was always shocked that no one seemed to care about what was going on, the killings, the murdering, the depth of despair that was going on in those places. As a kid, I didn't know the percentage of 80%. But I was aware that a lot of black people were killing a lot of other black people. It was creating an atmosphere of despair. And there's never a sense of accountability. There's always this patronizing that, oh yeah, black people do this because their lives have been so made so impossible by the evil white devil. But to me, I couldn't care less what the white man has done 100 years ago. If I have a gun and I put it right on the temple of another fellow black man, let's say I'm black, and I put that gun right on the temple of a black man and I pull the trigger and I blow his brains out, I don't think I could say, hey, the white devil made me do it. I can't go around and blaming the white man and without turning myself into an animal and into an inferior animal, as if to say, I am not a human, I'm not a complete human, therefore I'm not capable of not killing another black man just because I want to. I believe that every individual, no matter the color, is human, and as a human, he or she is accountable for his or her actions. And if we just justify this type of behavior, we are actually inadvertently saying you are not as human as the white man, because white people don't go around doing that. White people don't go around killing other white people at the same rates and levels as black people. But that is a topic for another audio clip. The point is that this activist group, which has absolutely no raison d'être, it's only destroying black communities and black lives, because it's not targeting the source issue. The black churches are not targeting the source issue. Instead of jumping up and down and singing hallelujah, they should be talking about the righteousness of the God of their Bible and saying what is right and wrong and teaching morals and ethics so that young black kids can grow up with a sense of integrity and character and have hope in their lives. But that's never going to happen under the current scheme, but at least these liberals have these activist groups that go around looting and doing all sorts of things and protesting and all this ridiculous feel-good nonsense that other white people also engage in just to feel less guilty about their white privilege. But at least they are out there fighting because they have this offensive mindset. And you can say the same thing with Antifa, which is actually, its correct name is Pro-Demfa. Because they are supposedly anti-fascist, but they, in truth, they are supporting and defending the true fascists in America, who are the Democrats. So they are pro-Democrat fascism, because that's the only party that goes around censoring people, that goes around doxing people, and making sure that anyone who dares to question their ideology is put down, silenced, and destroyed. And they go after people, destroy their lives, destroy their reputations, because they are the true fascists in this country. But conservatives will never reach the level of intensity that these leftist groups have, because they are bent on just conserving ridiculous traditions as they light their candles and worship the founding fathers and the U.S. Constitution that is so poorly written. It is a national shame the more we depend on it. So now going back to the Constitution and to the issue of what happened on January 6th and the election that was stolen, all that happened around that just evidences how destructive federalism is, especially in the area of elections and voting. So let's just to illustrate that. If you go to Article 1, Section 4 in the Constitution, it reads at the very beginning, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators." This one paragraph that I just read is a summary of all that the Constitution, at least up until the 14th or 15th Amendment, had to say about how to hold elections. In other words, the way that elections are held, the time, the place, and the manner is all up to the states. The Constitution had absolutely no say about how elections would be held. So it's up to the states. They can decide whatever they want. If they want only white people to vote, then that's the way it's going to be. And that's the way it was in the South. Or people, you know, certain states had certain laws that required that you own land or own certain amount of property. And if the states wanted to have it that way, that's the way it was. And think about it, the Constitution, the document that's supposed to protect your basic rights, the rights of the individual, didn't really, pardon my French, give a damn about clarifying or truly protecting the right to vote, which is so fundamental to make the whole system work. I mean, what is the point of writing all these paragraphs about, you know, how the Congress is to be organized and the Electoral College and all this stuff? What is the point of it if we don't have the right to vote protected and clearly defined? And so what we read is about the elections of senators and representatives. In other words, it's more or less related to Congress. And then I had to look around to see, okay, where do I find something about protecting the right to vote when it comes to presidential elections? And the only thing I could find was in paragraph, the third paragraph of Article 2, Section 1, where it says, "Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector." That's all. In other words, each state will decide how to appoint the electors for you know, to vote for the president of the United States. And as most of you may know, when an election is held, the general rule that has been adopted by most states, by 48 out of the 50 states, is that whoever wins the majority of votes in that state gets all the electoral votes. So if the Republican gets all the wins like 50% of the vote plus one person, he gets all the electors from that state. It's like a winner-take-all situation. And there are only two states where that's not the case, Maine and Nebraska, where they kind of distribute the electors a little bit differently. So some of the electors can go for the Republican and some for the Democrat, but it's their rules. And each state decides the way it wants to do it. So again, it's this lack of clarity because of federalism, because each state is like a sovereign little country, like a sovereign little country in this that has been stitched into this bigger country. And inside the sovereign state, the sovereign entity, they can do whatever they want, and the federal government can only look from the outside and maybe complain a little bit. But other than that, it is powerless. And it says, yes, it does say that the Congress, at least in the other article we read, has some power to regulate or alter the regulations of the elections. But the fact that each state can do whatever they want, they can run away with so many things, and then we have to wait for Congress to react in case something is so egregious that it has to be changed, that is not acceptable. And you know, Congress will never really act, especially if the Constitution is immersed in this thing that you don't mess with the states, you don't mess with the states' rights. then Congress will only act when it really, 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 really has to. And the first time that it really, 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 really had to was after the Civil War, after around 600,000 Americans had lost their lives, and Congress finally acted because the Southern states, rebellious as they were, didn't want to accept that slavery was over, and they were denying black people the right to vote. And you can see that's why the Congress was forced to put together the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment to force the states to vote to allow black people to vote. And Article 14, Section 2 is a kind of a long-winded paragraph. If you want to read it on your own, be my guest. But basically, what it kind of indicates is that if a state, let's say, denies or impedes the right to vote to 7% of its population, then that state will lose will be forced to lose 7% of its representation in Congress. And you read it, and when I read it the first time, I went, oh, finally, you know, there's finally a clear, you know, punishment for an inaction by a state, because that's very lacking in the Constitution, where if the state does something against the Constitution, there's no clear way of penalizing the state or punishing the state. This should be a contract this is a contract between the states that the states supposedly, according to the conservative terminology, entered into. And if you have a contract, then you have obligations. And if you don't fulfill the obligations, you know, just like a lease on an apartment or a flat, you enter into certain terms. And if you don't do certain things, or if you do certain things that are not right, according to the landlord, you're going to get penalized. And the penalties are supposed to be very clear. And they are penalties in such a way that you will be compelled or lean towards not incurring the penalties. But in this case, what they did was basically say to the states, if you don't allow 7% of the population, which happens to be black, to vote, then we're going to take, if we catch you doing that, we're going to take away 7% of your representation in Congress. Well, that's like saying to a thief, if you steal $100, then you will have to give $100 back to the person that you stole from. But, you know, that's assuming that we catch the person first. So if the person steals the $100 and no one can, you know, prove that that theft happened, then the thief will get away with $100 more in his pocket. But if he gets caught, what's the penalty? Oh, he has to give the $100 back. So you're basically telling the thief, if you can get away with it, you know, awesome. But if you don't get away with it, then you'll end up the same as if you had not stolen. So a thief will have nothing to lose. So if a state is blocking 7% of the population from voting, for example, they are basically saying, I'm taking over that 7% of representation in Congress. I'm stealing that representation. So when the Constitution says, well, then we're going to take that 7% away from you, well, they already had stolen it. So they're just giving it back if they get caught. So that's just an example of how sometimes the word that comes to me is idiotic. You know, sometimes how idiotic the Constitution seems when you think more and more about it. So it's so sad that this document is so worshipped. But when you go to the 15th Amendment, it says the rights of citizens of the United States to vote should not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And then it says the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. When they wrote this, you know, it was Republicans trying to ensure that black people were allowed to vote in the South. That's why they put this in. But you would start to think, well, that should have started the thinking, well, we haven't defined who and who shouldn't have the right to vote in the Constitution. It was all reactionary. So they were seeing that a certain race was not being allowed to vote, and they had to go and add it to the Constitution. Okay, you can't deny or abridge on account of race. And then it just very ambiguously says, the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. What legislation? So, and if you have a Congress of Democrats, and the Democrats in the South are stealing the elections, robbing black people the right to vote, then clearly the Congress will just cross their arms and do nothing. So this is stupid. This is stupid. And then and this was in 1870, so almost 100 years into the birth of the nation, and we still have no clarity on who has the right to vote. At least now we know the race, a person's race, cannot be a parameter to decide whether you can vote or not. And then we had to wait a long time for another explanation on our right to vote. And it was in the 19th Amendment, which was passed in 1920, that said that allowed women to vote. So now you couldn't deny or abridge the right to vote based on gender. And that was it. And then the same vague comment, the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article. So so then we had to wait a long, long time until the 24th Amendment in 1964. Let me see if I can find it here. The 24th Amendment is the famous poll tax amendment, the one that says the right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president for electors, for electors for president or vice president or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged. I hate that term. It's so ambiguous. Shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay poll tax or other tax. And then Section 2, again, the lazy clause. The Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So, they didn't bother to explain what is a poll tax? What are we talking about? And other tax. And this became a gaping hole, a Pandora's box for the voter ID controversy that we have today. Because Democrats take this as an excuse to say, no, you can't have a voter ID because that would make our fraud more difficult. Because voter ID requires you getting your license, a driving license or something, a state ID, and that costs a little bit of money. I forget how much it cost me the last time I got my ID, but it's not that much, and you have to go waste one day of your life at the Department of Motor Vehicles, so it's a waste of time and money. So you do have to make a bit of a sacrifice to get your ID, but once you get it, you got it. And it's not that expensive, but because the writers of the Constitution, in this case, the writers of the 24th Amendment in 1964, were not clear on what poll tax meant. They just left it as this thing that can be interpreted a million different ways. And they didn't even bother about other things. But we'll talk about that in a moment. Then we have to wait until the 26th Amendment for another explanation as to who has, about our right to vote. And it says, the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age. And then the Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. The same lazy clause again. It's like they have this template that just copy pastes and just keep changing the condition. So now the condition of age can if you're 18 or older, then you cannot be denied the right to vote. So you see that every time that something comes up, we come and add another amendment, so there's never any clarity. Why? Because everything is left to the states. And because it's left to the states, then that's why we have the problems we have, because each state does things its own way. And I will state this principle, and I hope it makes sense to you. Just like the old saying in America that all politics is local, I would also say all corruption is best when it's local. Because if you can do something locally, you can do it outside of public view. And you can control circumstances better. You can control things so that your fraud and your illegal act can be less visible. And that's what happened in the 2020 elections. Because each state could decide how to do things, they could kick out observers the way they wanted, and it was not being controlled from a centralized system, then all hell broke loose. And some states chose the Dominion voting system, and because each state has its own database, and when they wanted to get the audits, then nobody had access to the passwords, as was happening in Arizona, because it's all local. If it was a national thing, it would be much more difficult to have pulled off this massive electoral fraud, because it would have been much more visible. There would have been much higher levels of accountability, and doing this at the national level for a country of 300 million people would have been much more difficult than doing it locally. Because when you do it locally, you can control things better, and you can circle your wagons whenever someone from the outside comes in and says, okay, let me show me what you have there. Oh, it's our stuff, and we're not going to show it to you because we are a sovereign state. And that's why the election was lost. It was lost or stolen because of federalism. And conservatives are still stupid and don't understand that is the reason for the problem. It's the Constitution that you worship that led to this. And it was not that big of a problem before because the people in power were a little more moral and ethical. But things have changed. And all the gaping holes in this terribly written document are just being made evident and being exposed and exploited by the people who want a different kind of country. And they're getting it. And the conservatives still playing defense. The offensive line just holding the defensive linemen charging, and then they have a quarterback with the ball behind them who's never running, never passes, and just sits there, and then he gets sacked, and we have a loss of down and loss of yardage. And there's never a moving forward. And then in the meantime, we have all these crazy radical left-wing groups just advancing the ball and cheating and doing a lot of holding in illegal plays and moving the ball forward and scoring touchdowns and winning the game. And that's how it will continue as the Republic continues its demise. The United States American Republic died on November 4th, 2008. That's when the American Republic died, and we've been in purgatory ever since. And we will not come out of purgatory, and we will end up in hell, in the eternal loss of this country, if we don't wake up. And my phrase would be, to hell with federalism. It should be burned in hell, and we should be sincerely reconsidering the current Constitution. We have to write a new one, a one that's based on rights, and it's written from a much sounder perspective than this horribly, horribly written document. And I know this audio clip ran very, very long, but thank you very much for listening.